calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So what is it? Capitalism? Capitalists? Democracy? A republic? Is there a difference between government and economy? Within the hour, by the way, Alan Greenspan is going to be, well, he's not going to be replaced, but the President Bush says he's going to announce the replacement for Alan Greenspan within the hour. So we will keep up to track on that. In fact, the folks in our chat room are monitoring it. Even as I speak, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. Welcome to our program. I'm Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, and streaming around the planet. Glad to have you with us. Andrew Bernstein is with us, and Andrew is with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. He's the author of a new book, The Capitalist Manifesto. And Andrew Bernstein, in his realm, in the realm of the objectivist thinkers, in the realm of following on the traditions of Ayn Rand, a realm that, you know, frankly, as you know, I largely disagree with, but I have great respect for. I think Andrew is one of the great thinkers of our day. Andrew, I'm honored to have you back in the program with us.
Well, Tom, it's good to be back.
Thank you very much. I hope all is well with you, and I hope your book is doing well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The Capitalist Manifesto. Now, you wrote a piece. I thought this was really interesting. It was essentially an Ayn Rand Institute press release, but I'm guessing it's going to be reprinted in other places. And let me just, again, preface this, as I feel like I must so often. I get people who send me emails going, why are you giving conservatives time on your radio station or stuff like that? And first of all, you would not describe yourself as a conservative.
Not in the least.
Okay.
If nothing else, conservatives tend to be religious, and I am a rational atheist. But I think I'm a liberal in the true sense of the term, Tom, a supporter of liberty and individual rights.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Okay. And
classical liberal. You know the tradition.
Well, actually, the classical liberals came out of the writings of Rousseau and Locke, the Enlightenment, and they suggested that there was a social contract, that we are all in this together, that we actually have obligations to each other, that there should be things like common property, that there is this thing called the commons, that society trumps individual property rights. And I'd suggest, Andrew, that you believe the exact opposite.
Well, I sure do, and I think that the principle of individual rights that emerges from Locke and from the Enlightenment thinkers and the founders of this country, I think, is what makes us free and what makes us wealthy. And I think that's the problem.
We're kind of cherry picking from Locke and Rousseau, because you can get both out of their writing, you know.
Well, I'm not an admirer of Rousseau, but I mean there are certainly things in Locke that I greatly admire, including the principle of property rights.
Sure. Yeah, his famous saying, life, liberty, and the ownership of private property, which Thomas Jefferson changed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration
right.
of Independence. In any case, in your piece, Capitalists versus Capitalism, you suggest capitalists are often the worst enemy of capitalism. Let's, just to put a finer point on this, let's first define what is a capitalist, or what is capitalism in your mind?
Well, capitalism, I think, was defined by Ayn Rand as the system of individual rights, including property rights. And I think that's the system that makes us free and that enables us to achieve wealth. And I think capitalists, and in this case, I don't just mean financiers who supply the capital to growing businesses, but I'm using the term more broadly as profit-driven business individuals. And businessmen and businesswomen are not necessarily supporters of capitalism. There's a whole history of business people opposing the system of individual rights and calling for greater and greater government controls over the marketplace.
Now, you use the phrase liberal or white rights, if I may say, and I don't mean this as a slam, but rather glibly. I mean, the bottom line really isn't the dictionary definition of capitalism, and I don't have it in front of me and probably haven't looked at it in a decade or more, but isn't the real definition of capitalism a person who earns their living through the use of their money, of their capital? In other words, if I earn my living by investing in companies and the return on that investment is my income, even if I never do a day of, quote, work, end quote, in my life, the work that I'm doing is having the intelligence or having the capital to put it to work for me. A capitalist is a person who derives their income through the use of their capital. Is that not true?
Yeah, I think that's the little definition. Yeah.
Okay. Now let's take it. Let's take it.
I'm talking about business people.
Right. I understand. But let's take it to the second step then. If capitalism is a system by which people can invest in things and derive profit from that, including their own factories for that matter, but you know they can also passively invest. And a capitalist is a person who invests and derives their income. Where did the first wealth come from?
Where did the first wealth come from?
Right.
The first wealth comes from the human mind and being productive and working to create the goods and services that human life depend on, whether we're farming or whether we're manufacturing steel or automobiles or software or computers. The wealth comes from human creativity. It's primarily the work of the mind. I think Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged makes a brilliant case for that.
So, early days, we got a bunch of us, we're sitting around a fire, and somebody, well, for example, one of the examples that Peter Farb in his book Man's Rise to Civilization, which is probably the best documentary of the pre-contact American tribes, Native American tribes across the United States, points out that the only tribes that he could find in the United States who pre-contact with Europeans held slaves were those in the Pacific Northwest where the salmon ran twice a year. And because the salmon ran twice a year in such large quantities, some people were able to capture large quantities of the salmon, smoke them, preserve them, and put them behind a lock, and then say to everybody else, you want food, you got to come to me. They were the first capitalists. They owned the first capital. And they were also, it was also the only society that Farb could find. And this is a really good scholarly work. It was written back in the 60s and is still around. They were the only society that he could find that held slaves. Isn't capitalism a form of slavery?
No, the exact opposite is true. I think the system that emerges from the Enlightenment in Great Britain and the United States in the 19th century, is the system of individual rights. It's the system that protects individual rights of all people. In fact, abolitionism, as I'm sure you know, is an 18th century development. It's a development out of the Enlightenment principle of individual rights. And I would argue that abolitionism and capitalism are intellectual blood brothers. They both proceed from the principle of individual rights, the inalienable right of each individual to his own life and the pursuit of his own happiness.
Except
in the Capitalist Manifesto, I have a chapter on slavery arguing exactly that.
Except that the slaves were viewed as capital, and a capitalist owned his slaves.
But that's basically a Marxist understanding of what capitalism is. I'm arguing.
You don't think that the slaveholders thought of their slaves as property?
Listen, they're mistaken. The human beings aren't property. I mean, the Nazis and communists, I'm sure, think of the people they conquer as inferior beings or from a.
But they didn't think of them as property.
Class, but they're wrong.
But they didn't think of them as property. Okay, well, I'll give you that they were wrong.
They used slave labor, though, huh?
Sure, and we still do today, only we just call it imports from China. But, I'll give you that they were wrong. And I think, to a certain extent, you're right there, Andrew. So, where I have a problem is where you make the leap. You say that the capitalists are protecting individual liberties, and yet, what happens when one person owns, like as in the case of the North American tribes around the Columbia River who had the salmon, what happens when one person owns most of the capital and everybody else has to come to that person if they want to eat or they starve? How can you call that balanced power? How can you say that everybody else has a right?
I don't think that's an accurate rendition.
But isn't defense? Doesn't defense of liberty require balance of power?
I don't think so. No, I think people's rights have to be protected. I think you need a government to protect their rights, but I don't think you need to have balanced power in the sense of equal property or equal wealth.
I'm not talking about equal. I'm just saying that if you have in a system of absolute unrestrained capitalism, absolute laissez-faire capitalism, in the absence of government interference in the market, which I believe is what you're advocating,
yeah,
you will eventually end up in a system where a very small number of people own virtually all the wealth, and how could you then say that all those other people have liberty?
Well, I think that's clearly not the case. I think the system that I'm concerned to promote and defend, again, is the system of individual rights, where we have the right to freedom of speech, we have the right to freedom of religion, we have the right to start our own company, we have the right to own property, including our own home. the more widely implemented that system is, has never been fully implemented, but close to it in late 19th century America, you saw standard of living skyrocket. All these poor immigrants came here and they were able to make much more money than they were in the non-capitalist homelands that they fled. And the point is, the principle of individual rights protects my freedom to work.
Now, a lot of that wealth came from stealing it from Native Americans. It came from free land. That was the result of most of the wealth in the 19th century in the United States. Andrew, let me give you an opportunity to answer that after the break. Can you stick around?
I can stay for a few more minutes, Tom, and I got to get to class.
Oh, okay. We have about a 3-minute break here we've got to take, and then we can go to the bottom of the hour. Is that possible for you?
To 12:30?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can do that.
Super. Okay, great. We're talking with Andrew Bernstein, adjunct professor of philosophy at State University of New York. He's the author of The Capitalist Manifesto, AYNRAND.org. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I get up every morning and ignore the global warming. Head out to the Oval Office, start my day. I keep my donors all protected so I can be re-elected. Give them access just as long as they pay. And to the corporate crooks who keep cooking up the books, we make sure we look the other way.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, that's George W. Bush taking care of business. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with Dr. Andrew Bernstein, ayanrand.org, the website, The Capitalist Manifesto, his new book. Andrew, is there a website for your new book, by the way?
Well, you can go to my website, Tom. It's just andrewbernstein.net, and all the information on The Capitalist Manifesto is up there. It's just andrewbernstein.net.
Okay. Now, Andrew, how do you deal with, this bumper music that just came in was kind of very apropos to this. In the capitalist system that you're suggesting, see, in my worldview, capitalism is an economic system and Republican democracy is a political system. But I get the sense that in your worldview, capitalism is part of a governmental system. So how do you prevent those capitalists who have the most capital from rejiggering the rules so that those of us who have less capital don't get screwed?
Well, you know, regardless of semantics, Tom, the system that I'm concerned to support is the system of individual rights. And, you know, in that system, if anybody initiates force or fraud against an innocent victim, including if is a wealthy businessman, that's against the law. It should be against the law. It's a criminal action. And if that's what happened in Enron, for instance, if those people robbed their investors, then that's a crime. It should be a crime. And those guys should not only go to jail for a long time, but I think whatever wealth they have left should be taken from them and given back to their victims as restitution. So I think, objectively, I think a crime is the initiation of force or fraud, and that should apply to wealthy business people, to politicians, and to everybody else, not just the little guys like you, like me.
But Andrew Bernstein, if I'm a capitalist and I've got, you know, zillions of dollars and I'm building a railroad and I've got a bunch of people who want to work for me because they need to work in order to eat or they starve, and I say to them, I'm not going to give you enough money that you can have a middle class life. I'm not going to give you enough money you can put your kids through school. I'm not going to give you enough money that you can have a pension. I'm not going to give you enough money that you can have health care. I'm just going to give you enough money that you can keep from starving and you can show up and work for me. How is that not force or fraud?
Well, aside from the fact that starving workers have a choice in a competitive marketplace to work for that guy or to work for somebody else or to start their own company, as some people do, even aside from that, the economics here is that on a free market, we've seen the enormous productivity of capitalism, Tom, and that's what raises the real wages of workers. That's why workers can afford to buy cars or houses or, you know,
actually, I would suggest, Andrew, what
is really a post-capitalist development. That didn't exist prior to capitalism. Maybe they had their little hovels or their huts, but, you know, having a house of your own and a piece of property, that's made possible by the enormous wealth produced on the free market.
I would argue the opposite, Andrew. Andrew Bernstein, I would say that is capitalism, and that the middle class that we've seen, and every time there's been a middle class, by the way, in history. It's been the result of either labor organizing together, like in the guild system in Europe during medieval times, or in the United States after the Wagner Act in 1935, or because of the interference, what you would call interference, and the projection of government into the marketplace saying, hey, wait a minute, the rules of the game of capitalism, the rules of the game of business are such that if you're going to play, that if an employee, if a worker is going to participate with the capitalist in doing this dance together, playing the game of business, the capitalist has certain obligations to the employee. They can't simply, use them up and throw them away. That labor actually, as to quote Abraham Lincoln, labor precedes capital. This is my original point. Where did the first capital came from? It came from somebody thinking of something or making something. It came from somebody, and not necessarily just one person.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree. I think that with one point, I agree that the original capital comes from somebody's effort, bodily effort, and especially the intellectual effort. And I would insist that the product of that person's effort belongs to him or her to do with as they please. But I strongly disagree with the statist idea that the government interference in the lives of individuals, capitalist or otherwise, and the violation of their rights raises anybody's standard of living.
So you're opposed.
Increased productivity.
Right. I understand. We only have about a minute left here, Andrew. We're talking with Andrew Bernstein, The Capitalist Manifesto, andrewbernstein.net, his website, ayanrand.org. You're suggesting that we should have no regulations, that the government should not be in the business of regulating, and in fact, it sounds like you're really actually opposed to democracy, where we the people might get together and decide to put some limits on things.
I am opposed to democracy. The only regulations I think is that the government should impose are the criminal laws to protect honest people from those who...
But who decides what's a crime?
But I do believe in a constitutional republic. I believe in a written constitution protecting the inalienable rights of the individual. I think democracy is a form of totalitarianism. It's the reign of the majority. It tramples the rights of the individual. That's my problem with democracy.
So you want a constitution that protects the rights of capitalists exclusively?
No. Protect the rights of all individuals. I mean, I don't think a capitalist should have the right to rob or murder a worker any more than the workers have the right to rob or murder a capitalist.
Okay, well said. Andrew Bernstein with Ayn Rand, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, andrewbernstein.net, right, Andrew?
Yes.
.net is his website. He's the author of The Capitalist Manifesto. It's available now. Andrew, thanks for being with us today.
Any time, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Always great having you with us. It's
thanks.
A Tom Hartmann radio program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, indeed. This is the 2006 elections here. That's what we're talking about. 34 minutes past the hour, 34 and a half. Tom Hartmann here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hello. George Bush has announced that Bernanke is going to be the new Fed chairman. He's 51 years old. He is President Bush's chief economic advisor at this moment. So let's see. We have a president who thinks, and I'm assuming his top economic advisor must be going along with this, who thinks that it's just a fine thing to run up the biggest debt in the history of the United States. And if you take all of the money that was borrowed by all of the presidents in all of the wars we fought, all of the national disasters we've had, all the crises from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to the World War I to World War II, all of that, and simply borrow more than that just to make the economy look good, just to be able to hand off money to your campaign contributors and your good buddies, that's a fine thing, and that if you blow open the borders of the country and let multinational corporations decide the rules of trade rather than we the people, after all, that is the capitalist way to do things. And so all those jobs go to China because, hey, who wants to pay $15, $20 an hour to somebody to make shoes when you can pay them 20 cents an hour? It is the capitalist way to do things. then Ben Bernanke is apparently Bush's guy. He's apparently George Bush's, very much George Bush's guy. So Bernie Sanders took on Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan was actually, it's really ironic that we would have Alan Greenspan and Bernie Sanders. We would have this, I just want to play this little clip for you following Andrew Bernstein, because Andrew Bernstein is with the Ayn Rand Foundation. Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged, who is in many cases the philosophical foremother of today's conservatives. You'll find, you know, very, very little light between Andrew Bernstein's positions and those of, for example, Grover Norquist or Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan was actually initiated into the, you know, I say the word cult, I don't mean it in a negative way, I just don't know a better word, the club of objectivism by Ayn Rand herself in her apartment in as I recall, 1956 in New York City. Here's Bernie Sanders talking to Alan Greenspan before Congress, just you know, telling him, "Hey, sir, give some thought to some of these things."
Mr. Greenspan, I have long been concerned that you are way out of touch with the needs of the middle class and working families of our country, that you see your major function in your position as the need to represent the wealthy and large corporations. And I must tell you that your testimony today only confirms all of my suspicions. And I urge you, and I mean this seriously, because you're an honest person. I think you just don't know what's going on in the real world. And I would urge you, come with me to Vermont. Meet real people. The country clubs and the cocktail parties are not real America. The millionaires and billionaires are the exception to the rule. You talk about an improving economy while we have lost 3 million private sector jobs in the last 2 years. Long-term unemployment has more than tripled. Unemployment is higher than it has been since 1994. We have a $4 trillion national debt. 1.4 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Millions of seniors can't afford prescription drugs. Middle-class families can't send their kids to college because they don't have the money to do that. Bankruptcy cases have increased by a record-breaking 23%. Business investment is at its lowest level in more than 50 years. CEOs make more than 500 times of what their workers make. The middle class is shrinking. We have the greatest gap between the rich and the poor of any industrialized nation, and this is an economy that is improving.
Yeah, this, of course, this capital, laissez-faire, unrestrained capitalism. Now, I'm not opposed to capitalism. What I am opposed to is capitalism that is unregulated, because unregulated capitalism will destroy itself as it nearly did in 1929. Anyhow, Bernie Sanders continues.
I hate to see what would happen if our economy was sinking. Now, today, you may not have known this. I suspect that you don't, but you have insulted tens of millions of American workers. You have defended over the years, among other things, the abolition of the minimum wage, one of your policies, and giving huge tax breaks to billionaires. But today you reached a new low, I think, by suggesting that manufacturing in America doesn't matter.
Just send it to China, essentially Greenspan, and say, hey, it's all capitalism. It doesn't matter. You know, countries don't matter. It doesn't matter where it's made. Just, you know, if it's made in China, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter where the product is produced. We lost 2 million manufacturing jobs in the last 2 years alone, 10% of our workforce. Walmart has replaced General Motors as the major employer in America, paying people starvation wages rather than living wages, and all of that does not matter to you. Doesn't matter if it's produced in China, where workers are making 30 cents an hour, or produced in Vermont, where workers can make 20 bucks an hour. It doesn't matter. You have told the American people that you support a trade policy which is selling them out, only working for the CEOs who can take our plants to China, Mexico, and India. You insulted Mr. Castle. Mr. Castle, a few moments ago, a good Republican, told you that we're seeing not only the decline of manufacturing jobs, but white-collar information technology jobs. Forrester Research says that over the next 15 years, 3.3 million U.S. service industry jobs and 136 billion in wages will move offshore to India, Russia, China, and the Philippines. Does any of this matter to you? Do you give one whit of concern to the middle class and working families of this country? That's my question.
Ben Greenspan says,
Congressman, we have the highest standard of living in the world.
No, we do not. You go to Scandinavia and you will find that people have a much higher standard of living in terms of education, health care, and decent paying jobs. Wrong, Mr. Greenspan.
May I answer your question?
You sure may.
Thank you. For a major industrial country, we have created the most advanced technologies, the highest standard of living for a country of our size.
And now we've sent it all to India and China, but that's okay.
Our economic growth is crucial to us. The incomes, the purchasing power of our employees, our workers, our people, are by far more important than what it is we produce. I submit to you that, may I? The major focus of monetary policy is to create an environment in this country which enables capital investment and innovation to advance. We are
now. There is the key to the whole thing, and this is what the new Fed chief, Ben Bernanke, is in all probability going to be promoting, is that the major policy is to create an environment in which capital investment can succeed. It doesn't matter how much people are paid. It doesn't matter what kind of benefits they have. It doesn't matter what kind of living they can make. It doesn't matter if they can put their kids through school. They are free, after all, to go find another employer. Good luck if if the employers have gotten together and set the floor, but they're free.
At the cutting edge of technologies in the world, we are doing an extraordinary job over the years, and people flock to the United States. Our immigration rates are very high, and why? Because they think this is a wonderful country to come
to. That is an incredible answer.
Yeah, well, why is because many of the countries around us, particularly in Central and South America, are so much more badly managed than we are. They're oligarchies. And, if you're confronted with an oligarchy versus a kleptocracy, what are you going to take? Jesse in Tucson, Arizona on the line. Hey, Jesse, welcome to the program. You're live on the Tom Hartman program.
Hello.
Jesse, welcome.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about, I think it was Mr. Bernstein who was talking earlier, and he was referring to that he advocates personal rights. I think the factor that I would like to hear his perspective on is who defines what personal rights are and what those limitations are. And I agree with you, Mr. Hartman, that if that's not put into a check, if there's not something overlooking that and monitoring that, that those with the wealth will eventually rewrite or redefine what personal rights are and their boundaries.
Well, it's not a matter of eventually. I mean, when this country was started, they did that. They said people who had dark skin didn't have any rights.
Exactly.
Now it's people who don't have any money don't have any rights. Look at, 87,000 people a year in the United States, it's estimated, die because they don't have health insurance. They don't have any health insurance rights.
And I think that's the factor he's not considering, and it's a very important factor. And another note, I don't hear it's mentioned enough, but I think the media should almost be considered as another branch of the government. It has so much power.
Well, it was. The media is the only business, the only field of business that was actually carved out by the founders and put into the Constitution. It's in the First Amendment. That's it. Just the media.
Yeah.
That's why it's called the Fourth Estate.
It's been very disappointing lately, and it hasn't been a source of checks.
It hasn't. It hasn't been ever since Ronald Reagan, number one, stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and allowed non-media companies to start buying media, number one. And number two, since he stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, which, by the way, I'm personally opposed to the Fairness Doctrine in and of itself, but there were a whole bunch of rules around it that required stations to do public service in order to keep their license. And those are not being enforced, and they should be again. Jesse, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you there in Tucson. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
duty to spend and to buy, to prove to Bin Laden I'll shop till I die. I'm a world-class consumer, I'm sure of my role. I vote with my dollars for corporate control. I'll prove that I'm royal and rush to the store, where spending is my contribution to war. And the American flag's on the counter for sale. We're all made in China by prisoners in jail.
Ah, yes, good old laissez-faire, unrestrained capitalism. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our number. Once again, let me say, I am a capitalist. I started my own businesses. The first one, I suppose I'm not a capitalist with my first one. I started it with my unemployment check. Louise and I started an herbal tea company in our bedroom back, you know, when we were in our early 20s. This was many long ago and far away, and actually made a fair amount of money with it. But, you know, I'm not opposed to capitalism. I'm not opposed to free enterprise or business. I'm all in favor of it. But it has to operate in an environment where we, the people, say we're going to set the rules. We're going to define what this means. Jerry in St. Louis, Missouri on the line. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, I wanted to defend philosophy.
Okay.
These guys like to play kind of a word game. When they talk about rights, it always slips into freedom from. They're always emphasizing how the state should protect us from things. They never open the question, what are we free to do? And it seems to me that if you're going to talk about rights, you're going to have to talk about freedom to have access to medical care, to other things in life. They never mention that. They always go back to the kind of police function.
Well, that's because that's not part of their vernacular, Jerry. And I think that Franklin Roosevelt said it best in July 27th, as I recall, of 1936, when in Philadelphia he accepted his party's renomination for president. And he said, an old judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. And in other words, if you're hungry, you're not free. People could say you're free, but you're not free. If you don't have adequate clothing, if you don't have adequate shelter, there's, you know, Abraham Maslow came up with this hierarchy of human needs, and
right.
At the bottom of the hierarchy of human needs, there's basic life and safety needs. And once those are met, then you can start achieving emotional and social and self-actualization needs. And that bottom of that hierarchy of needs has to be organized and historically has been organized and protected by societies, by cultures, by we together, whether it was clans, tribes, families, or eventually in the last 7,000 years, nations and nation states.
Well, I didn't mind if those Randy and lunatics went on, but when they brought in philosophy, I thought it was being dishonest, because there is an analysis of freedom and rights in philosophy, and to just dismiss that whole part of the literature is just illegitimate.
Okay, well
so
said,
thanks,
Jerry.
Tom.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. And you make an excellent point. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Hi. Tampa Bay, where there is no hurricane.
Aha!
But
okay.
Doesn't prevent the capitalist free enterprise power company from turning the power off about every 15 minutes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Just went
is it because it's being rerouted around the state?
Who knows what they're doing? Look, it goes off when the weather was beautiful. The power still goes off here.
Yeah.
You think you're living in a remote island, but that's capitalism for you. Oh, power just went off. In any event, I wanted to talk about Greenspan to show you how out of touch this guy is. I heard on a radio show that apparently he went to some charity celebrity type of event so that the wealthy can be entertained and get a tax deduction simultaneously.
Right.
He won a Porsche Boxster. And when he was interviewed about driving it, he indicated he hadn't driven an automobile since the early 60s.
Right, because he always has
our limousine.
Exactly. It's just like George Bush Sr. showing up in a supermarket and going, gee, these scanners, they're amazing. When did they invent these things? You know, and everybody suddenly gets it. This guy hasn't, you know, he's always had people do his shopping for him. The question now, I mean, Alan Greenspan is going. Alan Greenspan is on record as having said that he felt that his job was to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity in the United States, a certain level of worker fear, a certain level of unemployment, to maintain that in order to not have what he calls wage inflation. He doesn't care about CEO inflation. The question is, what about Bernard Bernanke, you know, this guy who is Bush's lead economic advisor? Is he going to be better, worse? What are his policies going to be? And I have to add, Alan Greenspan is getting out of there as fast as he can because he knows the House of Cards is going to come tumbling
absolutely
down.
Absolutely. And And the other thing is, I'll predict it'll be cheap money. He's not going to be increasing, you know, the prime rate to the banks, because that's not in George Bush's economic interest.
Yeah, but on the other hand, he's risking hyperinflation. I mean, they're doing such a balancing act now because Bush has run this economy so badly into the ground. It is just absolutely incredible. Phil, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Alice in Eureka, California. Some words of wisdom for us, Alice, from your 91 years.
I call in to speak with Jan every time you have him on, but I never get through. Perhaps you can answer for him.
Okay.
Do you share the goal of today's Republicans that extreme wealth and extreme poverty is a desirable objective?
Well, Yaron would say, I can't put words in his mouth, but I believe, and he didn't take any calls, Alice, it wasn't just you. And but my guess would be that what the objectivist would say, I can't speak for Yaron, or in this case, Andrew Bernstein, what they would say is that they don't believe that their system is going to produce extreme wealth and extreme poverty. They think that capitalism will produce the middle class. Unfortunately, history kind of puts the lie to that or contradicts that, let's say. Well, what we find in history is that in history, the only time middle classes have emerged have either been when labor has been able to organize in the form of guilds in the Middle Ages or in the form of unions, or when government has intervened with things like minimum wage laws and minimum working or maximum working hour laws. So that I think would be the answer. Is that okay, Alice?
Okay.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear from you. In other words, I would guess that he would probably say that he's not a Republican and he disagrees with the Republicans on a lot of things, like democracy, for example. You know, on it goes. Thank you for being with us in this hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, a place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC, the true free speech zone. No barbed wire or passes required. You can just come in and speak your mind.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Ben. Ben S. Bernanke has been nominated as the replacement for Alan Greenspan at the Fed as the chairman of the former of the Federal Reserve Bank. He is himself a former Federal Reserve governor, long been considered a favorite for the post, according to the New York Times. The stock market doesn't appear to be freaking out as a result of that. In fact, someplace on this computer I had a list of, you know, what was going on with the market. And in any case, actually the New York Times homepage would tell us, wouldn't it? So we'll see how the market is responding. It appears that the market is up, actually, 105 points. So, in other words, from business's point of view, Bernard Bernanke is viewed as a guy who's he's pretty much going to just, you know, do what Greenspan did. In other words, screw the workers, help the CEOs, promote American business. Not promote American business. Promote business, even if it's not American business. So we'll see as time goes on how this goes. Hurricane Wilma hitting Florida right now, 125-mile-an-hour winds. More reports on that as time goes on. And 11 reported killed in bombings near Baghdad hotels. We don't have a report yet whether we have hit 2,000 deaths. Cindy Sheehan, I spoke with her earlier on my local program. And Cindy Sheehan said that when the 2,000th death of an American service person occurs in Iraq, that she's going to head over to the White House and tie herself to the fence, an act of civil disobedience. And, of course, in doing so, she'll get arrested. And she says when she gets out, she'll go and do it again, and they'll arrest her again. And she's just going to keep doing that. And so we'll see how this plays out. This should be very interesting to see, you know, in general, how this thing plays out. Judy Miller having some problems right now, by the way. The Wall Street Journal, Joe Hagan wrote a fascinating piece in the Wall Street Journal. This is, I have been saying now for over a year, probably for over 2 years. In fact, no doubt about it. I've been saying, you know, ever since 2002, ever since the fall of 2002, when the Republicans were trying to gin up their war, and the New York Times was running articles on their front page by Judy Miller, quoting Ahmed Chalabi, the convicted bank swindler. He was convicted of swindling banks in Jordan, a bank fraud in Jordan, and sentenced to 27 years at hard labor. And he is, you know, they don't have an extradition treaty with Iraq right now. So he's now in charge of the, you know, of oil and money in Iraq, for all practical purposes. He's one of the top 5-10 guys in Iraq right now. Where did he flee when he was in trouble? Iran. What are the allegations that he was a spy for Iran all along? What did Iran want out of the U.S.? Well, they very much wanted, you could argue, I think successfully. They wanted the U.S. They wanted Iran out. I mean, Iraq out, excuse me. This is, so, you know, it may well be that they actually got what they wanted. You know, that we did the work. We did the work for Iran. Could it be? Is it possible? So anyhow, we'll get into all those and other things as time goes on. At the moment, however, David Engwich is with us. David is the author of this, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. You know, occasionally, everything you know actually is wrong. Sometimes.
But you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? David Engwich is an artist, social inventor, and street philosopher, considered one of the world's most innovative thinkers on traffic, community life, and urban design. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. The website, mentalspeedbumps.com. David, you suggest in your book that if we were to replace traffic lights with nicely colored lawn furniture in the center of an intersection, that things would be better. Explain, please.
What I'm showing is that there are basically a range of mental speed bumps that get traffic to slow down automatically. They include intrigue, uncertainty, and humor. And so what we're trying to do is to bring social life back into the street again, because it automatically slows traffic. In the book, I document how that when we move kids out of the center of the street, told them not to play there anymore, we were actually giving the motorist the permission slip to go faster. So the speed of traffic on residential streets is governed to a large extent by the degree to which the residents have psychologically retreated from their street. So what we're doing is reversing that retreat.
But what's wrong with cars going faster?
What's wrong with it is that it kills off the social life of the street. It's not that people actually want the traffic to go slower. It's the fact that it damages the quality of their neighborhood life.
Then why not do away with the cars? Why not do Mackinac Island, Michigan, for example? There's no cars there.
Yeah, sure. In the short term, that's probably not totally practical. What we're trying to show...
Well, you could replace them with mass transit. I mean, there's large chunks of Portland, Oregon, for example. You can get on any trolley, any bus for free anywhere, as long as you're in the city limits. And there's a lot of people walking, not a lot of people driving.
Sure. But what I'm showing is, and what I believe is, that you change it, that everybody has to recognize their sphere of influence for making a better world, and most of us don't have the power to put the mass transit in. If I was talking in a one-on-one conversation with whoever's got the power to do that, certainly I would be advocating that. But the book is really to empower people to not engage in the politics of blame, which is nothing will change until somebody else does something, but to give people practical tools that they can use themselves to change their world.
And you're suggesting that getting rid of stop signs is a practical tool?
Yes, but even before you get rid of stop signs, what I'm saying is if you start to move some of your everyday activities closer to the street, that that will start to automatically slow the traffic. So, for example, instead of walking your kids to the park to play, take a chair out and supervise the kids playing on the sidewalk. Instead of reading a book at the back of the house in the sun, take your rocking chair out into your parking bay, sit there and read your book. It doesn't cost you any extra time, but you'll be slowing traffic in the process. But not only that, you'll begin to build the social life of your street, and it's the social life of your street that will bring the traffic speeds down.
We're talking with David Engwich, a social inventor working in Australia. You credit a lot of the concepts that you have to Hans Mondermann. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Traffic engineer working in Holland who discovered that removing all traffic signs, speed bumps, line markings, and traffic lights actually reduced traffic speeds and made streets safer. Could that just be because people not knowing that they had a safe right-of-way are driving more cautiously? I mean, that's the logical thing, right?
That's basically the logic of it. Hans Mondermann and myself independently both discovered the same thing. That is that both intrigue and uncertainty will automatically slow motorists down. Now, I do it by building the social life of the street. He does it by through engineering, which is to remove the things that convey a sense of certainty in the space.
Yeah, we're talking with David Engwich, an artist, social inventor, and street philosopher. He's the author of a new book called Mental Speed Bumps. David, we have less than a minute left. I would say TV is more of an obstacle to social life in the street than traffic. How do you respond to that? I mean, what do you do about that?
I would probably agree with you, and that's why I'm saying that the answer is traffic is a social and cultural problem, and it includes many, many other elements besides cars. And if you came to one of my lectures or if you read my book, the heavy emphasis is about rebuilding the social life of your neighborhood. It's not about calming traffic per se.
So if you're going to pull down street signs, let's pull down cable TV systems as well?
Maybe. Maybe
yeah.
We need to. Yeah, it is up to communities to take a holistic approach to these issues.
Or at least turn off the TV in your own home.
Turn it off and go out and play with your kids in the street.
Yeah. Marvelous ideas. I mean, speaking to someone who lived for 16 years without television, I think it's a marvelous idea. I'm just, how do you convince people this is practical in 10 seconds or less here, David?
It's to think about what things you are currently doing that you can move closer to your street. It needn't cost you any time at all. And once you start doing that, you will build the social life of your street. And
There you go. Well said. David, mentalspeedbumps.com, the website. David Engwich, thanks for being with us, David. Much appreciated. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We were hiking past the White House late one night when our eyes beheld an eerie sight. The president appeared with folks very strange, the zombies and vampires of global climate change. It's not global warming, say oil company disciples. Our math tells us it's natural weather cycles. These claims from industry heavies let the president rest behind his own protective levees. They're doing the climate mash.
The climate mash.
Real science is bad.
The climate mash.
Solutions are tried.
The climate mash.
And they do it for the cash.
Yeah.
The creatures were having fun. Our Congress was overrun. We couldn't tell the mindless zombies from the elected ones. Now we can stop this. We have the technology. But first we have to get past industry ideology. We need your help. I'm glad to show you how. Tell your leaders in Washington to save our climate now.
You're doing a heck of a job, zombie. Hey, the snow melted. Great.
There you
so
go.
We can drill over here.
Welcome
Yeehaw.
Back. That is actually the real Boris Pickett, the guy who did the original Monster Mash. For those of you old enough to remember, he has a new Climate Mash, and climatemash.org, I believe, is the website. It might be .com. You have to check it out. But anyhow, Boris Pickett, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 23 minutes past the hour. And the Republicans are already testing. They're running the trial balloons. How, if somebody gets charged with, for example, perjury, what are they going to do about it? How do we deal with this, the Republicans are asking, how do we deal with this thing if Karl Rove is charged with perjury or Scooter Libby? Or even worse, what if George W. Bush or Dick Cheney are indicted or are not indicted but are listed as unindicted co-conspirators in a charge of perjury? You will recall Bill Clinton was impeached in the House of Representatives and was tried in the Senate of the United States, tied up our business for 2 years for the charge of perjury. Oh, this is a real crime, they said. This is a major crime, this perjury stuff. This is a huge big deal. As Asa Hutchinson said on February 2nd, 1999, member of Congress leading the charge to convict, this was Senator Hutchinson, to convict Bill Clinton in the Senate. Something needs to be said that is a clear message that our rule of law is intact and the standards for perjury and obstruction of justice are not gray. And I think it is most important that we make that statement and to be on the record for history. I very much worry that with the evidence that we have seen, the grand juries across America are going to start asking questions about what is obstruction of justice, what is perjury, and I don't want there to be any lessening of the standard. Because our system of criminal justice depends on people telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's the linchpin of our criminal justice system. And I don't want it to be held any other way, he says. Well, now, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, something a little different, she says.
I certainly hope that if there is going to be an indictment that says something happened, that it is an indictment on a crime and not some perjury technicality where they couldn't indict on the crime, and so they go to something just to show that their 2 years of investigation was not a waste of time and taxpayer dollars.
It's just perjury. It's not a crime, says Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. What do you think, Victoria?
Well, somebody needs to go back and dig up what she said, because I'm sure she said something when President Clinton was being accused of
yeah.
the same thing.
Well, I was just quoting Asa Hutchinson, who was, you know, saying perjury is the worst of all the crimes because our entire criminal justice system rests on people telling the truth when they're brought before a grand jury.
Right. And what is a perjury technicality? Does that mean it was a technical lie but not a spiritual lie or something? I don't get that.
Well, what they're trying to do, this along with their, you know, the Fox News criminalization of politics thing, you know,
yeah.
which is...
Michael, criminalization of politics, Michael.
You know, that I've got this whole 60-second clip, but everybody's seen it and heard it by now, but of Fox News, you know, of every single Fox commentator, for all practical purposes, using this phrase, criminalization of politics, they're trying to say, it's no big deal.
Exactly. Now, it's interesting that Scott McClellan was asked today by, I think it was John Roberts of CBS, about Kay Bailey Hutchison's thing, but also about how the surrogates seem... No, actually, it was David Gregg of NBC. The surrogates are out there basically trying to discredit the prosecutor. And, of course, he wouldn't comment on that. But the press, to give them credit, is already on that. So that's at least encouraging. I didn't get an answer to my question today, Tom.
What was your question, Victoria?
My question today was, Harriet Myers, in her capacity as White House counsel, did she view it as part of her duties to urge the leaker, if there was one, to come forward
and to avoid the embarrassment? That's right. She was the lawyer for George W. Bush. She should have protected him.
Or did she? Then he said, blah, blah, blah. He talked about how they were directed to cooperate. And I think I then added, or did she view it as her duty to protect the leaker?
Yeah. Or was she of the opinion, like George, that...
I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official... Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you tomorrow. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Bosses of the world, unite. Let us save the day.
Yes.
Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay.
How dare those workers?
We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our homes. The pressures are incredible, and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti, and now we have to move from there.
Oh, isn't it tough?
They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day from Malaysia to Mexico. At that rate, pretty soon, there'll be no place for us to go.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, worker bosses of the world unite. Yes, indeed. Well, is Ben Bernanke, I believe it is, going to be one of the bosses of the world who unites with them? Interesting. Over on the Wall Street Journal, taking Bernanke's measure, they've got a blog going on, the Econo blog. And they're listing, folks weighing in on his selection. Mark Thoma says, I do not believe Bernanke will politicize the job as much as Greenspan did. My worry is the opposite, that he will not speak forcefully enough on issues such as the budget deficit that impact monetary policy. How will Bernanke differ from Greenspan? He's a much stronger advocate of inflation targeting than Greenspan. That's interesting. And he's much more likely to push for publicly announced inflation targets. An advocate of Fed transparency. It may turn out that this guy is actually a decent guy. What a surprise. A nominee coming out of the Bush administration? Tyler Cohen writes, he's an excellent choice, first-rate economist. His specialty is macroeconomics, big-picture economics. So the question in my mind, here I am, I'm looking through all of these comments, is a whole bunch of them, essentially, number one, that he's a safe, strong choice, that the bond markets, the equity market, everybody's going to like him, he's a decent guy. And the second, that after FEMA, Michael Brown at FEMA and Harriet Myers and all these kind of screwed up confirmations, Bush really had no choice. He couldn't pick somebody who was an ideologue, somebody who was a sycophant, somebody who was just going to suck up to him. But instead, he actually had to go out and find somebody who was competent. Competent, what a surprising idea. Now, here's the question on my mind. Let's say that Ben Bernanke is a competent macroeconomist. Macroeconomist. In my opinion, Alan Greenspan has not been. Alan Greenspan essentially stood by the sidelines. Well, actually, he encouraged Ronald Reagan to bankrupt the Social Security system, to bankrupt the Social Security Trust Fund. The Social Security Trust Fund was started under the Reagan administration. Up until Reagan came along, Social Security brought in money from current employees and paid out money to retirees and people who were incapable of working. One-third of all Social Security recipients, let's keep in mind, are not retired persons. They're, the kid born with multiple sclerosis or muscular dystrophy, or they're the widow of somebody who has died. The one-third of all people who are drawing Social Security are not retired employees. But in any case, up until Reagan came along, and this isn't Reagan's fault, by the way, unlike most things. Up until Reagan came along, the way Social Security worked was it brought in money, it paid out money, and it was doing just fine. And then in the late 70s, under the Carter administration, actually, they started looking forward and saying, there is going to be this bulge, sort of like a rabbit going through a python, when the baby boomers start to retire. And this is the result of World War II. During, you know, after there was 4 or 5 year period, 10 year period, more, you know, 4 or 5 year period anyway there, very few babies born in the United States. Everybody was off fighting World War II. All these guys come back from World War II. The economy is booming. The pent-up demand is exploding. It feels safe. You know, it's a good, safe time to have a family. People get married. They have children. And all these kids were born between 1945 and 1955, just this explosion of children that are referred to as the baby boomers. And when they start to retire in 2020, 20, you know, 2015 through 2045, more or less, when they're retiring, then there's going to be so many retirees that the current workers won't be able to pay for them. So let's say that for the first time in the history of Social Security, since it was started back in the 1930s, for the first time since the beginning of Social Security, we're going to have one single generation do two things. Now, up until this point, up until 1982, every generation, the generation of the 30s and 40s, the generation of the 50s and 60s, the generation of the 70s and 80s, every generation had simply paid for the retirement of the previous generations. A generation roughly being every 20 years. But they said, the baby boomers, however, are not only going to pay for the generation of the people who preceded them who are retiring. In other words, not as a baby boomer myself, not only am I paying into Social Security for my father's retirement, but the baby boomers are also going to pay for their own retirement. It had never been done before. And when the last baby boomer dies, we'll go back to the system as we had it before, where the current workers are paying for the retirees, period. In other words, the only generation that will have to pay for its own retirement will be the baby boomers. They're going to double pay. Literally double pay. And so Reagan doubled, and this was the proposal that came out of the Greenspan Commission, along with Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the congressman from Connecticut, I believe. In any case, the Moynihan Commission with Alan Greenspan, they came up with this thing, and they said, okay, we're going to have the baby boomers pay double. They're going to pay both for the retirement of the people who are currently retired, and they're going to pay for their own retirement. And the way they're going to pay for their own retirement is we're going to create a giant savings account. We'll call it the Social Security Trust Fund. We're going to double the tax that the baby boomers paid. The Social Security tax went from 6% up to 12%, more or less. We're going to double the tax. It's only going to hit those people making less than, I think it was around $40,000 a year. In other words, we're only going to hit the working class people. This, of course, was Alan Greenspan who helped come up with this idea. It's not going to affect millionaires. They can talk about flat taxes all day long, but they don't want flat taxes when it comes to Social Security. Bill Gates makes $1 billion, fine. He pays Social Security tax on the first, today it's the first 90,000. Back then, in the 1980s, it was like the first 35,000, 38,000, 40,000, something in that neighborhood. So Bill Gates makes $1 billion. He pays Social Security taxes on the first 80,000, and then after that, he pays no Social Security tax whatsoever. Somebody who makes $1 million a year, they pay Social Security tax in the first 80,000. After that, no more Social Security tax. Because a flat tax for Social Security would solve all of Social Security's problems. They won't have that. What? Can't have that. But in any case, so the baby boomers are going to pay not only for their own retirement, not only for the retirement of the people who are retired currently, but they're also going to put money into a savings account, into a bank account that will earn interest that they then can draw down when they start to retire roughly in 2015, 2020, something like that. And this savings account was called the Social Security Trust Fund. So Ronald Reagan gets this brilliant idea when he becomes president from Lafler, you know, Alvin Lafler. Hey, you know, if you reduce taxes, you'll increase government revenue. Now, it didn't make any sense then. It never has worked before. But Reagan bought into it. Reagan wasn't a particularly bright guy when it came to economics. He was a great actor, but, you know, and he particularly was brilliant at playing the role of president of the United States. But he really didn't know anything about governing and governance. And so Lafler comes along, and all these billionaires and millionaires who had surrounded Reagan, like Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz, who previously had been the president and vice president of Bechtel Corporation, one of the richest and most powerful corporations in the world, privately held corporations. He's got all these millionaires and billionaires around him, and they're saying, cut the taxes on the wealthy. Because when Reagan came into office, the top tax, you know, if you only made $30,000, $40,000 a year, you only paid 10%, 12% income tax. But if you made $2-3 million a year. You still only pay 10-12% income tax on the first 30 or 40 thousand, and then you get up to 100,000. You start gets to 20%. You get to 2-2, and it would start creeping up there to the point where it was the top rate was 70% when Reagan came into office. So the millionaires and billionaires said, get rid of that. Cut it down to 28, 29, 30%, something like that. Cut it all the way down so that millionaires and billionaires aren't paying these taxes and more revenue will come in. Governments will make more money because those millionaires and billionaires will start spending all that money and it'll stimulate economic activity. So Reagan did it, and it didn't work. It was a disaster. The country went into an incredible deficit. Now, if the country just went into a deficit, government spending slowed down, and then the economy fell apart, then it would have been a terrible disaster. So Reagan is like, what do I do? You know, this thing is blowing up in my face. Alan Greenspan comes along and says, here's the solution. Start borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund, the savings account for the boomers where they're saving for their own retirement. Start borrowing money from that and loaning it to the general fund because it's government-to-government borrowing. It won't show up as part of the deficit. Nobody will know. Until 2024, when they start retiring, nobody will know. And so Reagan was able to make it look like we had a good economy, even as he was bankrupting Social Security. George Herbert Walker Bush followed him doing the same thing. Bill Clinton followed him doing the same thing, although at least to Bill Clinton's credit, he pointed out that he was doing it, and that was Al Gore's whole rap about the lockbox for Social Security. This was, you know, an issue in the 2000 election. Al Gore was saying, let's stop doing this with Bill Clinton's support. And George W. Bush, of course, is doing the same thing, borrowing money, all of the surplus in the Social Security. There's not a penny left. It's all been borrowed and spent. And this was all Alan Greenspan's idea. So now we've got this new guy, Ben Bernanke, coming in. And if he's an honest economist, you know, with some integrity, what's he going to do about this? What's he going to say about this? Is he going to start telling the truth? Because there's some, I'm telling you, the Republicans have been burying some pretty deep, dark secrets here with regard to economics for the last 25 years. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
People speak of love, don't know what they're thinking of. Wait around for the one who fits just like a glove.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. National Review Online, NRO Online, nationalreview.com. This, of course, the conservative publication, William F. Buckley's conservative publication. They don't seem to much like Ben Bernanke, which actually encourages me. They say he applauds tax cuts, free trade, and legal reform, but a supply-sider he is not. His views on how tax cuts impact the economy is odd interest. This is an article by John Tammany. His odd interest in demand charts, and not to mention his discredited beliefs about limits to growth and full employment should have Bush supporters concerned. This is the conservative point of view. Very interesting. They say he's clearly in the Keynesian camp on taxes, holding that they should be reduced during times of slack demand and increased when economic growth reaches its natural limits. Keynesians basically believe that an economy is driven by demand, people wanting to buy things. Supply-siders say that the economy is driven by capitalists building factories. In other words, offering supply. If there's enough, which makes no sense. I mean, think about it for a minute. It just makes no sense. But nonetheless, that's what supply-siders believe. And so here's a supply-sider say, Ben Bernanke is a bad guy. Interesting. Maybe George Bush accidentally has introduced somebody really good. Fred and Clinton Washington on the line. Hey, Fred, what are your thoughts on all this? Fred? No, Fred.
Hello.
Hey, Fred, welcome to the program.
Boy, I'm on pretty quickly. Thanks, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great. What's up?
Hey, you know, we're talking about economics, et cetera, and the new choice for Federal Reserve Chairman. And I thought the national debt would be germane to the topic, so I called in. And I heard Bernie Sanders on earlier. You were playing a recording of him berating Greenspan about the national debt and other things, and he mentioned that the national debt was $4 trillion.
It was a two-and-a-half-year-old clip.
Oh, okay. Cause
yeah. Cause it's pushing $8 trillion now.
The debt has gone up $4 trillion in 2.5 years.
More or less, yeah.
Woo! Where's conservative in that? I don't know. I know.
Before Reagan came in, we had never had a debt over $1 trillion. Reagan took it from around $700-800 billion, as I recall, to over a trillion in his first 2 years. By the time Reagan left, it was pushing $2.5 or $3 trillion.
Yeah.
It stayed there fairly stable. You know, it added about a half a trillion between Bush Sr. and Clinton. In fact, Clinton actually started reducing it, although when you take out the Social Security part, he wasn't. But nonetheless, he started reducing it. And so it was still stable in the three point something range. I don't have the numbers in front of me. It's from memory. And then Bush came in and pushed it past four, past five, past six to seven. Now we're pushing eight.
That's amazing. I mean, I just don't get where we get fiscally conservative when Republicans are speaking about, you know, what they believe in. It just that makes
we don't, and that's why you've got a few genuine Republicans like George Voinovich for that matter, you know, Olympia Snow and even, you know, John McCain saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right.
I mean, I think it's a good thing to be precautious, but what conservative has come to be in this country is in politics is just amazing to me.
Yeah.
And looking at the national debt now at $8 trillion, I looked at today at the national debt clock, it's actually over $8 trillion.
Oh, it is? Okay. I knew that they very recently passed legislation allowing it to exceed $8 trillion. I didn't realize it already had. Yeah.
If you look at the interest that we must pay on that, and I'm really not sure what that interest is. Do you have any idea what that is?
I don't. The only number that sticks in my head is that this year we're paying $160 billion on just the money that Reagan borrowed during his years as president in order to make the economy look good.
So we've got to pay interest on the entire $8 trillion in national debt. And let's say 5% is the number, right? I don't know what it is. It could be 6%.
Well, if it's 5% over 30 years, that means we're going to pay another $8 trillion in interest.
Well, it means that we pay $400 billion a year in interest. And it means that we pay on a monthly basis. I'm looking at a spreadsheet that I just put together here, and I can email it to you if you like me to. It means we pay $33 billion on a monthly basis.
Yeah, or $1 billion a day in interest.
In interest.
In interest. And coincidentally, $1 billion a day is the amount of money that this government is borrowing right now just to stay afloat. Fred, thanks a lot for the call and for the statistics. Great stuff. Dave in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dave, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Well, Tom, you were arguing last week with the Ayn Rand group that I heard you say that consumption was the more consumption, the better the economy. And I can't agree with you there at all. I mean, I think that there's a problem with that argument.
You think people buy things because they're available, not because they want them?
I think that overconsumption and unreasonable consumption is a major problem that we have with our economy.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree with you. But when you're looking at what grows an economy, if first of all, if you assume that growing an economy is a good thing, and I think that that's an assumption that we can challenge, and that's your point, but if you assume that growing an economy is a good thing, which is the big debate between the supply-siders and everybody else, the Keynesians, then, you know, they're saying that an economy grows because there's more stuff available, and history says that the economies grow because people want more stuff.
Well, okay, but also with the Ayn Rand group, you know, I read Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead early on. I mean, she makes some very fine points. She talks about the breakdown of big business. She talks about the corruption and problems with business. In many ways,
sure.
That was a... Pardon?
Sure, I agree with you. Ayn Rand did make some good points. The problem was she grew up in the Soviet Union. Her father's pharmacy was taken away by the Bolsheviks. She studied economics at the University of Kiev. And in her world... democracy doesn't count. It doesn't matter. In her world, it's capitalism versus communism. Communism was both an economic system and a political system. Capitalism isn't. Capitalism is an economic system. And she never really understood. You read her writings again in the context of, does this woman understand democracy? She doesn't get it. She doesn't understand democracy.
I hear you.
Yeah, and that's the big problem with and Dave, thank you very much for the call and for making the point. That's the big problem with objectivist thought and with libertarian thought and with what is so-called today conservative thought, is that they don't get it about the commons and about the social contract and shared responsibility and the fact that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, that we're essentially all in this together. I mean, they just don't get it. It's not part of their vocabulary. And that's the real disaster, in my opinion, of the idea that greed is good and will motivate all things and everything wonderful will come out of greed. Just ain't that way.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to our radio program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, CRN Digital, and AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome back to our program. The scary side of Ben Bernanke, the National Review, all upset about him. And one of the things that they say that they're all upset about him is that they say, he said, that the gold standard in the United States prolonged the Great Depression. Well, by interesting coincidence, or maybe there are none, who knows, Andrew Goss is with us. Or is it Goss? Andrew?
Yep, Goss.
Andrew Goss. He's an author, a currency expert, one of the nation's foremost authorities in the history and future of money in America. His website, www.usgoldcoins.com. I would guess, given that website, that you think that gold is a good thing. Do you think that the gold standard was a good thing?
Oh, indeed, yeah. A standard dollar is something, it's almost a necessity. I mean, how on earth are you supposed to save these things called dollars or contract your business in dollars if you don't know what a dollar is?
Well, the argument that was made for ending the gold standard, which ended during Nixon's years, was that the total value of all the wealth in the world, of all the things in the world that could be bought and sold, all the services in the world that could be bought and sold, exceeded the value of the gold in the world, and that gold was a commodity that was increasingly difficult to get, and therefore having a gold standard didn't make any sense.
Well, what would happen is gold would continually increase in value, and so then people would hoard it, and it wouldn't be useful for commerce. Now, I'm okay with the idea of an unbacked monetary unit,
which is what we have right now.
In other words,
it used to, just for our listeners who don't know, I can't say from the founding of this country. When was the gold standard initiated?
It was from the founding of this country. The Constitution is very specific. No state shall make anything but gold and silver.
But the reality was that even given that, I mean, this was one of the huge debates in the early Democratic Republican, the wars, and the Whigs
indeed
were all flipped out about this, was the creation of the national banks. This was Alexander Hamilton's whole idea, and the first national Bank of Philadelphia went bankrupt in the 1830s, and the Second National Bank went bankrupt in the 1840s, some say leading to the Great Panic of 1845, as I recall, and the Depression that followed that. And those were not banks that were using gold to back their currency. They were issuing fiat money.
Well, the idea was that anyone could issue fiat money, and meaning, in other words, if I have 10 ounces of gold in my vault and then I issue 10 one-ounce gold notes, that's even. But if I issue 15 or 20, well, that's fraud. And this is what happened from that period. Wildcat banks established. Anyone could establish a bank. They'd go out in the woods and set up a bank and issue notes that they didn't have gold or silver coin to back up.
Right, but there were two attempts actually to create federally chartered banks.
Sure,
this was Hamilton's dream.
Alexander Hamilton, partnership with the Rothschilds and with George Washington's blessing, created the first bank in the United States in 1792.
And it went broke.
Well, it didn't. It took over the world. It took over the country. It had a 20-year charter, and so when its charter ran out in 1812, we said, no, we're not going to do this because you guys are just a bunch of British interests. You're the same people that controlled us before the Revolution, so we're not interested in renewing your charter. With that, the War of 1812 broke out. Now, interestingly enough, the moment we changed our mind and said, okay, you know what, maybe we were a little hasty, here, we'll give you the second bank of the United States, and that, suddenly the war went away, and that bank prospered for 20 years until Andrew Jackson and the bank wars, when their charter expired the second time, he said, that's it, I'm killing you dead.
Right. In fact, he ran on that. I mean, that was Andrew Jackson's.
Yeah,
that the whole reason that everybody elected him.
Right.
And the reason that they elected him was because we were having these boom and bust cycles in the United States.
They could see that the bank was influencing. It was exerting exactly the influence that he said it would. Because in its death throes, as soon as this idea of killing the bank gained popularity, it started to take action. And
but those early federal banks, unlike the many of the state banks that were not disallowed by federal law, that were creating literally fiat money, that were just printing money.
Sure, unbacked.
Unlike unbacked money. Unlike those, that federal bank was creating money that was backed by gold. In fact, I remember back when I was a kid, the dollar bill said one, you know, federal, Federal Reserve note said, you know,
payable
federal,
to the bearer. Yeah, $1 federal, dollar, you know, and, yeah.
Payable to the bearer in gold.
But here comes the dirt.
And Fort Knox and all that. Yeah.
Well, let's stick with it for that thought for a minute, because this is an important line of thinking, all right?
Okay.
So the idea after Jackson kills the bank.
This is in the 1830s.
Then everybody gets to open a bank and do the same thing. You know, they'd put 10 ounces of gold, they'd issue 20 ounces of notes, and you didn't know whose bank to trust. It really impeded commerce. So essentially they came up with this concept. They said, well, let's make a federal bank, the Federal Reserve, right? We're going to have uniform currency that's good throughout the country. This will all be conducted under government charter, and so you don't have to worry about it.
Okay, now we're in the 20th century now.
Yeah, we've moved right through, you know, that entire wildcat banking period from the age of Jackson for the next 60 years. That's what dominated the landscape.
Right, and the Fed was created, wasn't it, in 1913? Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, prior to that, everybody had banks. Everybody was issuing more notes than they had gold. It was quite a hindrance to commerce because you had 900 different banknotes. So they said, look, let's make a uniform currency. We'll have this Federal Reserve system, and Federal Reserve banks can be chartered in each district and so on, and this type of regulation.
And we'll back it up with gold, and that gold will be held in Fort Knox.
And we'll give all the gold to the Fed in 1913. We'll give it all over to them, and then they'll issue notes for the gold, and it'll be nice and clean. But
the
secret is that from 13 to 33, the reason we had the roaring 20s is because the Federal Reserve was doing exactly what the charlatans did 100 years ago.
They were just printing money.
They were issuing more money than there was, in fact, gold to back it up.
Right, which is why Roosevelt made it illegal to privately hold gold.
Well, let's slow down. We're going a little ahead of ourselves because what happened next is that the bankers who were issuing this money understood what they had done, and so then as quick as they got a note, for a Federal Reserve note, they immediately cashed it in for the actual gold coin that it was supposed to be backing. And so soon, the treasury was almost empty, and that's when Roosevelt had the choice. He has all these notes outstanding. Either close, make them not redeemable, or, you know.
So he did it to try and stop the bankers.
Well, his other option would have been to gather up those Federal Reserve Bank presidents in a couple hundred feet of rope and find a tree, because what they committed was treason and fraud, and it was the very thing that we put that system in place to prevent. But what he did instead is he said, okay, from now on, Americans are no longer able to ask for the gold. We're going to say it's there. You know, we're going to put it all in Fort Knox, and it's going to stay there. Nobody's going to have it. It's just going to sit there, and then what we're going to do is pass these notes for money among ourselves.
Right.
And then that's essentially what we've done.
And that's what we had up until 1974,
72? See, you know, 72? Up until that point, a foreigner, from 33 to 74, we were on a quasi-world gold standard because any foreigner could still take his dollars and get gold. In fact, it was our number one ally through World War II, Charles de Gaulle, that started the train going in the 50s when he said, you know, Americans are issuing more notes than they have gold. And he, as quick as France got a paper dollar, they turned it into a gold one. And pretty soon, by 1973, there was virtually nothing left in the treasury. So Nixon said, well, that's it. He closed the gold window and said, no one gets gold anymore. And without even realizing it, the Arabs said, well, hey, well, we're not going to take paper for your oil, for our oil. We want gold. And that's what precipitated the oil crisis of 1973.
Now, to some extent, the reason why that happened, that inflation, that is to say the government printing more dollars than they had gold to back them, was the result of trying to have LBJ's guns and butter policy,
That's right.
It had to do with trying to finance the Vietnam War.
And boy, haven't we gotten to that ultimate conclusion today? See, where
and here we
LBJ,
are all over again.
And LBJ, in order to finance the war, right, they had to have some pain somewhere. And boy, the people just weren't feeling it and didn't want to deal with it. Today, they've proven to us that, well, you can have a war and a booming economy. You can have, you know, both social programs and the kind of programs that I think many of us are not in favor of.
All you have to do is just borrow it from your grandchildren.
Yeah, better yet, we create it and dilute it.
Well, no, if you create it, then we're in the Weimar Republic.
That's
how Germany paid off the obligations of the Treaty of Versailles.
Well, that's what we've done now. You consider that in 1995, there were $4.5 trillion in circulation. And now, 10 years later, October the 1st, 2005, We went over the $10 trillion mark. So in a 10-year period, we've doubled the money supply and then some.
And as a result, the value of the U.S. dollar has dropped some 30-40% against most international currencies.
It's not a surprise. That's
and it has a whole lot farther to go.
Absolutely. As we rocket towards $18 trillion by 2012.
That's
what we'll need just to pay the Social Security recipients.
Amazing. So, Andrew Goss, what I want to bring this around to is, you know, what does this mean to you and me, or not so much to you, to the average person? What are the consequences of this, both political
and
right? What can we do about it? And what role does the Fed play in this? And what about this Ben Bernanke guy who says that the gold standard actually prolonged the Great Depression? I mean, what does that tell us about what kind of Fed chairman he's going to be? I think these are all really interesting questions. And how it's going to affect the ability of people to make a living and have savings. We'll get into that with Andrew Goss right after this. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
But it's not the little piggies you have to worry about. It's the big piggies, the ones with the starched white shirts that you have to worry about. Indeed, the banker piggies, people.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean sheds.
There you go. That's what you got to worry about. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes, 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Andrew Goss. He's an author, a currency expert, one of the nation's foremost authorities in the history and future of money in America. The website, usgoldcoins.com. Andrew, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Apropos, you know, the cover of my latest book, Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, has the 12 little piggies on there hauling the pile away.
That's great. That's great. Well, you know, coincidences. So first of all, Ben Bernanke has been named the he has to go through, I believe, congressional muster.
He's done. Right through there, breeze through there. Yeah, he's a guy.
It'll be a done deal, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and but the fact of the matter is he's not yet the head of the Fed, but he will be.
Right.
And not a whole lot known about him other than that an op-ed that he wrote for the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago in which he implied that he was not a supply-sider, but he did, and he has a fascinating interest in demand charts. In other words, he was a little bit more of a Keynesian or Keynesian than...
Yeah, Keynesian, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, than the conservatives are comfortable with. And he
right.
also suggested that the this whole idea of the gold standard was one of the things that prolonged the Great Depression.
Yep.
What's your take on him? What's your take on that?
Yeah, he's more Keynesian than Keynes was, you know?
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. In other words, his belief, you know, Keynes had never seen this system work. It was only in his mind that it could work.
Which system are you talking about?
This fractional banking issue, more notes than you have paper. You don't really need gold to back your monetary issue.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding. My reading of Keynes, and it's been a lot of years, was that the primary area where he kind of brought something new to the table wasn't the idea that you could hyperinflate a currency. I mean, everybody saw the disaster of that in Germany going back to Holland in the 17th century.
Yeah, they didn't manage it properly. That
right,
was his
well,
argument.
But, no, well, no, but he, the main thing that he brought to the table was that if you have an economy that's sinking, then the government over the short term can borrow money in order to create employment like FDR did with the WPA in order to create employment. In other words, a government spending can be used to stimulate an economy. Not
exactly.
Spending
in general, whether it's government spending or any kind of social spending or any kind of manufacturing spending, just increased spending on credit would stimulate an economy, and government would be the prime engine to do that. But
right.
his belief was simply that if you keep the money supply growing, if you keep it growing and have that single source.
But it has to grow along with the goods and services, you have inflation.
Well, that was his argument that, you know, the tail wagged the dog, that as long as the monetary unit was growing in size and quantity of issue and therefore thereby decreasing in value, that friction would kind of just drag it through the system. And he's, you know what? I'm not going to disagree with what Keynes said. My whole disagreement is with who gets to do that. In other words, the guy who gets to add the extra money into the fire and the source of that money is what concerns me. I say let Congress do it. So if Congress issues, say, 10% of the money supply each year.
Which is, by the way, what the Constitution provides for.
Yeah. Let them just, rather than take our money in the form of income tax, just each year create 10% of whatever the money supply is and spend that. And so in that fashion, those that hold the monetary unit, including the one-plus trillion held by foreign people, they would see their unit fall in purchasing power.
By 10% minus the actual growth of
the
goods and services in the economy.
GDP,
but
right.
that's how Germany tried to get out of the Treaty of Versailles, and you ended up having a billion benchmarks to buy a loaf of bread.
Let's say they went a little overboard, Tom, because they did. You know, if you,
but I that's what
my,
they did.
I have my Ein Billion Mark note, and it's dated, you know, 6 months after my 1,000 Mark note.
Right.
That's crazy inflation. But I think the theory, the idea that, you know, 10%, well, hey, we don't have to test the theory because we've already done that.
Okay. Well, if I can interrupt you, Andrew,
yep.
I suspect that we might be just kind of shooting right over the heads of a lot of people because we're not defining a lot of terms, and we only have a minute here left in this conversation. What do you see coming down the road as a result of this appointment and this administration's policy?
Just what you see, inflation. I have no doubt that inflation is imminent. In fact, I've been warning my newsletter subscribers about it for 24 months or more.
In other words, buy commodities.
Anything physical, trees, you know, land, gold, you know, all the physicals, anything physical.
Yeah, commodities, as opposed to stocks.
Yeah, you don't want to buy debt, for sure. You definitely don't want to be holding, you know, any kind of bond debt because rates are going to rise.
Interesting.
And what about, they have to fight this commodity inflation.
Right, and buying other currencies?
Well, there's not very many sound ones left in the world. I prefer to stick with the Americans. Currency, the dollar, the 20.
Well, there's a lot of talk about the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar, New Zealand dollar.
Yeah, I like the $20 gold piece, you know, the $10 gold piece.
Yeah, because you can hold it in your hand.
Yeah, that's my store of value. I don't need foreign currencies when the one the Constitution gave me is good and strong.
So it's time, you think, for our listeners to get out of the stock market.
Well, I'll say this. If they want to read my works, I have 3 back issues. I'll send them free if they mention they heard it on Tom Hartman. Just call me at 800-468-2646. Make your own call. I think it's time to get out.
Okay, give it out again.
800-468-2646. Make sure you mention Tom Hartman or you'll be buying a subscription.
Okay, Andrew Goss, usgoldcoins.com. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Good
Thank
talking
you,
to you.
Bye-bye.
It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
Yeah, old George, you just needed to
be
able to shut us up.
The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow.
Biggest
Thanks
poppy
US
harvest
troops,
in the history of the world
it's back
in Afghanistan.
Today only goes to show. Go down Wall Street. Sell off my shares today. Tell my broker. Put it all in blow.
Yeah, welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Well, put it all in gold anyway. Might be a good idea. Or something like that. I agree with our last guest that my sense of it is that the economy seems to kind of go in these cycles. And I'm not wise enough about macroeconomics to know what's driving the cycles. But it seems that there are times, although it does seem that when Democrats are president, that the stock market tends to go up, and that's a good time to be in the market cycles. And when Republicans are president, that's when the market tends to go down, and that's a good time to be invested in the commodities cycles, buying gold, silver, platinum, oil, whatever, copper, those people who are into investing like that. But in any case, it's interesting. And as we learn more about Ben Bernanke, We'll be finding out more about where he's going to take this country, although pretty much everybody is saying, he is certainly saying, in the New York Times today, that he's going to keep on doing what Greenspan was doing. Now, that's kind of an odd thing to say, because here you had Greenspan, who jacked up interest rates like crazy in the late 90s, and then dropped them like a stone in the 2000s in order to try and pull the economy out of the disaster that George W. Bush put it into with three consecutive massive tax cuts and huge government borrowing. I mean, drove it into actually negative interest rate territories, and now is trying to prevent a disaster, frankly, as a consequence of the housing bubble that resulted from that, which I frankly... If Greenspan's words are to be believed, it caught him unawares, although you would think that, you know, common sense would tell you that that's coming. So anyhow, we'll see, you know, where this is going and what that means and how it goes. But the bottom line is that the economic viewpoint of the Republicans, the conservative Democrats, the conservatives, the Democratic Leadership Council, the Republican Party, is that if it's good for a multinational corporation, it's good for them. It doesn't matter about America and Americans. It doesn't matter about the average worker. Give them a lot of lip service. Give them a lot of, you know, good words. Yes, indeed, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that, you know, quack, quack, quack. But the bottom line is corporate profit. For example, the Washington Post today, article by Griff Witt. Headline, I know this is going to shock you. I know it's just absolutely going to shock you. Suspected illegal workers found at Halliburton job site. Where? In rebuilding New Orleans. Yes, indeed, my folks, just truck in a few illegals, and you too can make money in the rebuilding business. After all, they're doing it in Iraq. Say, what? No, they're not from Mexico. They're bringing them in from the Philippines. And from Malaysia. And from Thailand into Iraq and keeping them in very primitive barracks and feeding them essentially slop and giving them low pay. And a lot of them didn't even know that they were going to Iraq. They thought that they were being hired to work in Kuwait. But they're being paid a lot less than an Iraqi would demand, and they're certainly being paid a lot less than you'd have to pay an American. And then Halliburton gets to charge you and me big bucks. Well, anyhow, back to this article in the Washington Post, this by Griff Witt. Federal agents have identified 10 suspected illegal immigrants working at a naval base near New Orleans, where the Halliburton Company subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root is leading hurricane reconstruction, according to a spokeswoman for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Kellogg Brown & Root, by the way, we should note, is not an American company. It's a Halliburton subsidiary that was reincorporated offshore at about the same time that they were getting all these big, no-bid contracts to rebuild Iraq so that they wouldn't have to pay taxes to the United States of America on all that profit that they're making, on all those tax dollars they're receiving. Meanwhile, you know, the war started. Halliburton's stock was in the 20s. Now it's in the 60s. Dick Cheney's making out like a bandit. He's making more money with Halliburton than he is as vice president. What a surprise. Halliburton's got illegal immigrants working down in New Orleans. Work at the base, this again from the Washington Post today, work at the base has been a source of dispute in recent weeks because dozens of unionized electricians, many of them local residents who had their homes destroyed during Hurricane Katrina, claim they were let go by another Halliburton subcontractor, Alabama-based BE&K, in favor of lower-wage workers. That came after the Bush administration suspended the Davis-Bacon Act, a law that guarantees the prevailing local wage for workers under federal contracts. Now, this is exactly why the Davis-Bacon Act was put into place. It was so that if federal spending goes into a local economy in a way that may cause some dislocation of the normal rules of economics, that those rules will not be used to screw the workers. And guess what? Billions of dollars being spent down there. It's going to create incredible demand for labor. It's going to bring in a lot of labor. And you would think it would drive up the price of labor, right? Well, not when you can truck people in from Texas who will work for $5.15 an hour. But it's illegal to do that because of the Davis-Bacon Act. Well, George Bush, one of the very first things he did right after Hurricane Katrina, suspend the Davis-Bacon Act. This is incredible. I have to read this paragraph to you again. It's only two sentences. Just get, this is what's going on in New Orleans. This is the Washington Post. This is not, you know, the Nation magazine. This is the Washington Post. Actually, it's from Saturday's paper. Excuse me, I said it was today's paper. It's Saturday's paper. Work at the base has been a source of dispute in recent weeks because dozens of unionized electricians, many of them local residents who had their homes destroyed during Hurricane Katrina. You get this? They live in the area. They're unionized electricians. They know how to do electrical work. Their homes were wiped out by Hurricane Katrina. They really need the work. They're still in the area. They're ready to work. Claim they were let go by another Halliburton subcontractor, Alabama-based BE&K, in favor of lower-wage workers. That came after the Bush administration suspended the Davis-Bacon Act, a law that guarantees the prevailing local wage for workers operating under federal contracts. See, it's the same thing as my tariff argument. Under the Davis-Bacon Act, it says you got to pay the prevailing wage. Now, if you've got to pay the prevailing wage, then there's no incentive to bring in cheap labor from out of town. You're going to hire the local people who got hit by the disaster, and you're going to help out the local economy, and everything's going to be fine. But the corporation isn't going to make as much profit because they're not going to be able to exploit the fact that people are desperate. It's the same, it's my tariff argument. It's the, you know, it's, you say to a company, you want to make shoes in the United States where it costs $1, there's $1 worth of labor in a pair of shoes, or you want to make a pair of shoes in Malaysia where there's 10 cents worth of labor in a pair of shoes? You can make them in Malaysia, but you got to pay a 90 cent tax when you import them into the United States so that the labor cost is the same. It's going to cost you $1 to make them someplace anywhere, no matter where you make them. Say you make them in China and it's 3 cents an hour. We'll make the import tariff 97 cents. A pair of shoes, if there's 3 cents worth of labor in those shoes. This is how we protected industry in the United States and protected workers in the United States from 1787, when the first tariff laws were passed. And tariffs, by the way, were the major source of government revenue. The main way that the government ran itself was income from tariffs. That's how important they were from the founding of this country until the Civil War, when Lincoln had to impose an income tax to pay for the war. And then we went back to tariffs after the Civil War. In any case, that's how tariffs were. They basically protect the local workers. They protect American workers. And the Davis-Bacon Act was to protect local workers in areas that might be hit by calamities. Back to Senator Byron Dorgan, back to the Washington Post here. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota, he says, who's been following the case closely, said the discovery of illegal immigrants at the naval base confirms that Gulf Coast workers looking for livable wages are getting left out of federally funded reconstruction. Byron Dorgan said, and I quote, "I don't think there's any question that there's a pretty significant sucking sound there. If you were paying prevailing wages, you'd be hiring skilled electricians," end quote. This is the same thing Ross Perot was saying back when Clinton was running against Bush Sr. Ross Perot, the only guy who was willing to tell the truth about the economics of the thing. I mean, you know, let's face it. As much as I believe that it's essential that we take back the Democratic Party, that it's the only party that is not entirely corrupted, the reality is that most of the disaster of these trade policies were brought to us by Bill Clinton. But it's the Republicans who started the process. It's the Republicans who thought this is a great idea. And Clinton was just following along. He was doing what he had to do. And that's not to justify it. That's not to explain it. I still think it was a betrayal of America. Mary Landrieu, Democrat from Louisiana, expressed contempt yesterday for a system that allows companies working for the government to make a larger profit at workers' expense. Good on you, Mary Landrieu. Good on you. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, can't get fooled again.
People think I'm a moron. What if they only knew the depth of my evil genius? And I can be stupid whenever I need to, yeah. In my midnight confessions, I reveal my imperial secrets. I'm the master of misdirection, with a few intellectual defects.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, 9 minutes before the hour. Coming up on the top of the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Yes, time for a conservative alert. Ann Coulter, outspoken Republican pundit and author, energized and entertained more than 800 UF students Thursday night at the third annual Ronald Reagan Black Tie and Blue Jeans Barbecue. She criticized the media for being liberal and Democrats for whining about their rights under the First Amendment. They're always accusing us of repressing their speech, she said. I say, let's do it. Let's repress them. She later added, frankly, I'm not a big fan of the First Amendment. Your Republican moment. I'm brought to you courtesy of, I don't know. I just, you know, Sometimes it's just too much. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. And it looks like my software has just gone weird on me, so there we go. Phil in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. I want to just make a quick point about Keynesian economics and regarding your previous guest.
Yes, sir.
The free market is a lie. I saw a chart.
There is no
on,
such thing.
No, really. I saw a chart on C-SPAN several years ago, and it said it just showed clearly that every big decrease in military spending over the past 150 years was followed by a recession. The point is the free market doesn't work without huge public subsidy.
Yeah, well, the flip side of that, too, is, I mean, there's other ways besides just military spending. For example,
right,
you know, building
that.
Highways.
You're right, and I was going to add that, is that Keynes himself did not believe that military spending was the most efficient way to stimulate the economy, but and there's way better ways, exactly, public construction.
Well, and in fact, Keynes made the point, by the way, and I think this is an important one for Americans to get, that if you want to stimulate the economy by spending federal dollars on something, if you spend it on a bomb, say you spend $1 million on a bomb, that $1 million stops right there. And if that bomb blows up, it's gone, you know, or bullets or whatever else. If you spend that $1 million building a bridge, however, that facilitates commerce for 30 years.
Absolutely.
And that's called an investment. And that's why in the 1930s, really, starting all the way back with the WPA, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, right up until Reagan basically put an end to investment in infrastructure in the United States, which is why we have water systems and dams and bridges and things that are falling apart now because it's been 30 years. During that 40-50-year period, yes, military spending was going up, but even more important, there was substantial investments being made in the infrastructure of the United States. Not only was that stimulating the economy, it was also facilitating commerce.
Yeah, and you know, the free market guys, they always go, well, get government out of the way and everything will be wonderful. That's just simply not true. The economy needs huge public subsidy.
Well, the economy...
Right.
Yeah, to the extent, in a rational fashion. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. But if you say it without some sort of qualifier, then they'll jump all over you. I mean, you don't want the government spending money just for the purposes of spending money. But there are many things that you don't want the government spending money on. You don't want the government building TV factories. You don't want the government building airplane factories. You don't want the government building shoe factories. What you want the government doing are those things that have to do with the commons, those things that have to do with us collectively, we collectively, the transportation infrastructure, for example, the communications infrastructure, the water, septic. Those are the kinds of things, highways, roads, bridges. Those are the kinds of things that you do want the government doing. And when they do it, it actually does stimulate the economy. Good
Absolutely.
Point, Phil.
Take care.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Well said. Aaron, I don't see what city you're in, but welcome to the program.
I'm in Tacoma.
Ah, great. Hey, Aaron, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say for those that think the economy is
doing quite well, and they love the buying power they enjoy when they go to Walmart or whatever. The whole thing is contingent on the Chinese choosing to peg their currency to the value of the dollar.
Right, and they're very, very, very slowly moving away from that for fear of losing, you know, us as customers. And they really, you know, by borrowing $1 billion a day and borrowing about 30% of it from the Chinese right now, what Bush has done is he's turned the sovereignty, the power of the United States, over to the communist dictatorship of China.
Absolutely. Remember when there were two Chinas?
Yeah. Yeah. And now, you know, just 6 months ago, you had one of the top communist Chinese military guys saying, if you, the United States, defend Taiwan in any kind of conflict we have with them, we will nuke 100 of your cities. And Bush didn't say one word. Not one word.
Absolutely. We basically sunk Taiwan for all practical purposes.
Well, whether we've sunk them or not, I have a feeling they're going to go the way Hong Kong did, is that they're going to be absorbed, and I have a feeling that China is going to get a little more progressive. But the fact of the matter is that China for 2,000, 3,000 years has been basically a dictatorship, and in all probability will continue that way for another couple thousand years. They've simply figured out how to, you know, Lenin said, a capitalist is somebody who will sell you the rope that you're going to use to hang him. The Chinese have figured out how to use our own capitalist system against us, and they've done it very, very effectively. And it's really quite shocking to me. Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. It's really quite shocking to me how we have simply handed this over to them. And, of course, not just the Chinese, but they've been right at the forefront of doing this. And it is the policies of the Bush administration and the Republicans in office to just go right along with it. You know what? Sovereignty? We don't need no stinking sovereignty. We'll turn it over to the multinational corporations. We'll borrow the money from the Chinese and from the Saudis. The Saudis who are building, who are taking the profit from that money, the interest that we're paying them, and using it to build madrasas, to teach, you know, hatred of Christians and Jews in America. I mean, it's crazy what the Bush administration is doing. It's stuff that Joe McCarthy would have been yelling about way back when. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.